Chapter 7. Race. Inside the church sanctuary, some 4,000 mourners had already gathered, most of them African-American, many of them professionals of one sort or another, doctors, lawyers, accountants, educators, and real estate brokers. On the stage, senators, governors, and captains of industry mingled with black leaders like Jesse Jackson, John Lewis, Al Sharpton, and T.D. Jakes. Outside, under a bright October sun, thousands more stood along the quiet streets. Elderly couples, solitary men, young women with strollers, some waving to the motorcades that occasionally passed, others standing in quiet contemplation, all of them waiting to pay their final respects to the diminutive, gray-haired woman who lay in the casket within. Former President Bill Clinton rose to speak. In many ways, seeing the former leader of the free world and a son of the South acknowledge the debt he owed a black seamstress was a fitting tribute to the legacy of Rosa Parks. Indeed, the magnificent church, the multitude of black elected officials, the evident prosperity of so many of those in attendance, and my own presence on stage as a United States senator, all of it could be traced to that December day in 1955 when, with quiet determination and unruffled dignity, Mrs. Parks had refused to surrender her seat on a bus. In honoring Rosa Parks, we honored others as well, the thousands of women and men and children across the South whose names were absent from the history books, whose stories had been lost in the slow eddies of time, but whose courage and grace had helped liberate a people. And yet, as I sat and listened to the former president and the procession of speakers that followed, my mind kept wandering back to the scenes of devastation that had dominated the news just 2 months earlier, when Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast and New Orleans was submerged underwater. I recalled images of teenage mothers weeping or cursing in front of the New Orleans Superdome, their listless infants hoisted to their hips, and old women in wheelchairs, heads lolled back from the heat, their withered legs exposed under soiled dresses. I thought about the news footage of a solitary body someone had laid beside a wall, motionless beneath the flimsy dignity of a blanket, and the scenes of shirtless young men in sagging pants, their legs churning through the dark waters, their arms draped with whatever goods they had managed to grab from nearby stores, the spark of chaos in their eyes. I had been out of the country when the hurricane first hit the Gulf. 1 week after the initial tragedy, though, I traveled to Houston, joining Bill and Hillary Clinton, as well as George H.W. Bush and his wife Barbara, as they announced fundraising efforts on behalf of the hurricane's victims, and visited with some of the 25,000 evacuees who were now sheltered in the Houston Astrodome and joining Reliance Center. In the days that followed, I returned to Washington and worked the phones, trying to secure relief supplies and contributions. I appeared on the Sunday morning news shows, rejecting the notion that the administration had acted slowly because Katrina's victims were black. The incompetence was colorblind, I said, but insisting that the administration's inadequate planning showed a degree of remove from and indifference toward the problems of inner-city poverty that had to be fixed. Late one afternoon, we joined Republican senators in what the Bush administration deemed a classified briefing on the federal response. Almost the entire cabinet was there, along with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and for an hour, Secretaries Chertoff, Rumsfeld, and the rest bristled with confidence and displayed not the slightest bit of remorse as they recited the number of evacuations made, military rations distributed, National Guardsmen and women deployed. A few nights later, we watched President Bush in that eerie, floodlit square. The power had been generated just for his appearance, after which the darkness returned, acknowledging the legacy of racial injustice that the tragedy had helped expose, and proclaiming that New Orleans would rise again. And now, sitting at the funeral of Rosa Parks, nearly 2 months after the storm, after the outrage and shame that Americans across the country had felt during the crisis, after the speeches and emails and memos and caucus meetings, after television specials and essays and extended newspaper coverage, it felt as if nothing had happened. Cars remained on rooftops. Bodies were still being discovered. Stories drifted back from the Gulf that the big contractors were landing hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts, circumventing prevailing wage and affirmative action laws, hiring illegal immigrants to keep their costs down. The sense that the nation had reached a transformative moment, that it had had its conscience stirred out of a long slumber and would launch a renewed war on poverty, had quickly died away. Instead, we sat in a church, eulogizing Rosa Parks, reminiscing about past victories, entombed in nostalgia. I wondered what Rosa Parks would make of all this, and whether honoring her memory demanded something more. When I meet people for the first time, they sometimes quote back to me a line in my speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention, a line that seemed to strike a chord. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. For them, it seems to capture a vision of America finally freed from the past of Jim Crow and slavery, Japanese internment camps and Mexican braceros, workplace tensions and cultural conflict. An America that fulfills the promise that we be judged, not by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character. In a sense, I have no choice but to believe in this vision of America. As the child of a black man and a white woman, someone who was born in the racial melting pot of Hawaii, with a sister who's half Indonesian, but who's usually mistaken for Mexican or Puerto Rican, and a brother-in-law and niece of Chinese descent, with some blood relatives who resemble Margaret Thatcher, and others who could pass for Bernie Mac, so that family get-togethers over Christmas take on the appearance of UN General Assembly meetings, I've never had the option of restricting my loyalties on the basis of race, or measuring my worth on the basis of tribe. Moreover, I believe that part of America's genius has always been its ability to absorb and assimilate newcomers, to forge a national identity out of the disparate lot that arrived on our shores. In this, we've been aided by a constitution that, despite being marred by the original sin of slavery, has at its very core the idea of equal citizenship under the law, as well as an economic system that, more than any other, has offered opportunity to all comers, regardless of status or title or rank. Of course, racism and nativist sentiments have repeatedly undermined these ideals. The powerful and the privileged have often exploited or stirred prejudice to further their own ends. But in the hands of reformers, from Tubman to Douglas to Chavez to King, those ideals of equality have gradually shaped how we understand ourselves and allowed us to form a multicultural nation the likes of which exists nowhere else on earth. Finally, those lines in my speech describe the demographic realities of America's future. Shortly after 2050, experts project that America will no longer be a majority white country, with consequences for our economics, our politics, and our culture that we can hardly imagine. Still, when I hear commentators interpreting my speech to mean that we've arrived at a post-racial politics, or that we already live in a colorblind society, I have to offer a word of caution. To say that we are one people is not to suggest that race no longer matters. We know the statistics. On almost every single socioeconomic indicator, from infant mortality to life expectancy to employment to homeownership, black and Hispanic Americans in particular continue to lag far behind their white counterparts. In corporate boardrooms across America, minorities are grossly underrepresented. In the United States Senate, there are only 3 Hispanics and 2 Asian members, both from Hawaii, and as I speak today, I am the chamber's sole African American. To suggest that our racial attitudes play no part in these disparities is to turn a blind eye to both our history and our experience, and to relieve ourselves of the responsibility to make things right. To think clearly about race requires us to see the world through a split screen, to maintain in our sights the kind of America that we want, while looking squarely at America as it is, to acknowledge the sins of our past and the challenges of the present without becoming trapped in cynicism or despair. I have witnessed a profound shift in race relations in my lifetime. I've felt it as surely as one feels a change in the temperature. When I hear some in the black community deny those changes, I think it not only dishonors those who struggled on our behalf, but also robs us of our agency to complete the work they began. But as much as I insist that things have gotten better, I am mindful of this truth as well. Better is not good enough. My campaign for the U.S. Senate indicates some of the changes that have taken place in both the white and black communities of Illinois over the past 25 years. By the time I ran, Illinois already had a history of blacks elected to statewide office, including a black state comptroller and attorney general, a U.S. senator, and a sitting secretary of state who had been the state's leading vote-getter only 2 years earlier. Because of the pioneering success of these public officials, my own campaign was no longer a novelty. I might not have been favored to win, but the fact of my race didn't foreclose the possibility. This isn't to say that prejudice has vanished. None of us, black, white, Hispanic, or Asian, are immune to the stereotypes that our culture continues to feed, especially stereotypes about black criminality, black intelligence, or the black work ethic. If an internalization of anti-discrimination norms over the past 3 decades, not to mention basic decency, prevents most whites from consciously acting on such stereotypes in their daily interactions with persons of other races, it's unrealistic to believe that these stereotypes don't have some cumulative impact on the often snap decisions of who's hired and who's promoted, on who's arrested and who's prosecuted, on how you feel about the customer who just walked into your store, or how you feel about the demographic of your children's school. I maintain, however, that in today's America, such prejudices are far more loosely held than they once were, and hence are subject to refutation. I cannot prove this assertion. Surveys of racial attitudes are notoriously unreliable. And even if I'm right, it is cold comfort to many minorities. After all, spending one's days refuting stereotypes can be a wearying business. During my Senate campaign, I traveled with Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin on a 39-city tour of southern Illinois. One of our scheduled stops was a town called Cairo, at the very southern tip of the state, where the Mississippi and Ohio rivers meet, a town made famous during the late 60s and early 70s as the site of some of the worst racial conflict anywhere outside of the Deep South. Dick had first visited Cairo during this period, when as a young attorney working for then-Lieutenant Governor Paul Simon, he had been sent to investigate what might be done to lessen the tensions there. As we drove down to Cairo, Dick recalled that visit. How, upon his arrival, he had been warned not to use the telephone in his motel room because the switchboard operator was a member of the White Citizens Council. How white store owners had closed their businesses rather than succumb to demands of boycotters to hire blacks. How he listened to black residents talk about their efforts to integrate the schools, their fear and frustration, the stories of lynching, and jailhouse suicides, shootings, and riots. By the time we pulled into Cairo, I didn't know what to expect. Although it was midday, the town felt abandoned. Turning a corner, we arrived at a large parking lot, where a crowd of a couple of hundred were milling about. A quarter of them were black, about three-quarters of them white. They were all wearing blue buttons that read Obama for U.S. Senate. Ed Smith, a big, hearty guy who was the Midwest regional manager of the Laborers International Union and who'd grown up in Cairo, strode up to our van with a big grin on his face. "Welcome," he said, shaking our hands as we got off the bus. "Hope you're hungry, because we got a barbecue going and my mom's cooking." The barbecue was terrific, the conversation spirited, the people seemingly glad to see us. For an hour or so we ate, took pictures, and listened to people's concerns. We discussed what might be done to restart the area's economy and get more money into the schools. And by the time we left, I felt a relationship had been established between me and the people I'd met. Nothing transformative, but perhaps enough to weaken some of our biases and reinforce some of our better impulses. I believe that moments like the one in Cairo ripple from their immediate point, that people of all races carry these moments into their homes and places of worship, that such moments shade a conversation with their children or their co-workers and can wear down, in slow, steady waves, the hatred and suspicion that isolation breeds. My election wasn't just aided by the evolving racial attitudes of Illinois' white voters. It reflected changes in Illinois' African-American community as well. One measure of these changes could be seen in the types of the early support my campaign received. Of the first $500,000 or so that I raised during the primary, close to half came from black businesses and professionals. It was a black-owned radio station, WVON, that first began mentioning my campaign on Chicago airwaves, and a black-owned weekly news magazine, Indigo, that first featured me on their cover. Such capacity simply did not exist a generation ago. Although Chicago has always had one of the more vibrant black business communities in the country, in the 60s and 70s, only a handful of self-made men would have been considered wealthy by the standards of white America. Today, the city is not only filled with black doctors, dentists, lawyers, accountants, and other professionals, but blacks also occupy some of the highest management positions in corporate Chicago. They can afford to live in neighborhoods of their choosing and send their children to the best private schools. Statistically, the number of African Americans who occupy the top fifth of the income ladder remains relatively small. Moreover, every black professional or business person in Chicago can tell you stories of the roadblocks they still experience on account of race. Few doubt that if they were white, they would be further along in reaching their goals. And yet you won't hear these men and women use race as a crutch or point to discrimination as an excuse for failure. In fact, what characterizes this new generation of black professionals is the rejection of any limits to what they can achieve. When a friend who had been the number one bond salesman at Merrill Lynch's Chicago office decided to start his own investment bank, his goal wasn't to grow it into the top black firm. He wants it to become the top firm. Period. That simple notion, that one isn't confined by one's dreams, is so central to our understanding of America that it seems almost commonplace. But in black America, the idea represents a radical break from the past, a severing of the psychological shackles of slavery and Jim Crow. It is perhaps the most important legacy of the civil rights movement, a gift from those leaders like John Lewis and Rosa Parks, who marched, rallied, endured threats and arrests and beatings to widen the doors of freedom. And it is also a testament to that generation of African-American mothers and fathers whose heroism was less dramatic, but no less important. Parents who worked all their lives in jobs that were too small for them without complaint, scrimping and saving to buy a small home. Parents who pushed their children to achieve and fortified them with a love that could withstand whatever the larger society might throw at them. It is through this quintessentially American path of upward mobility that the black middle class has grown 3 to 4-fold in a generation, and that the black poverty rate was cut in half. Through a similar process of hard work and commitment to family, Latino Americans have seen comparable gains. From 1979 to 1999, the number of Latino families considered middle class has grown by more than 70%. And yet, for all the progress that's been made in the past 4 decades, a stubborn gap remains between the living standards of black, Latino, and white workers. The average black wage is 75% of the average white wage. The average Latino wage is 71% of the average white wage. Black median net worth is about $6,000, and Latino median net worth is about $8,000, compared to $88,000 for whites. When laid off the job or confronted with a family emergency, blacks and Latinos have fewer savings to draw on, and parents are less able to lend their children a helping hand. Even middle-class blacks and Latinos pay more for insurance, are less likely to own their own homes, and suffer poorer health than Americans as a whole. More minorities may be living the American dream, but their hold on that dream remains tenuous. How we close this persistent gap, and how much of a role government should play in achieving that goal, remains one of the central controversies of American politics. But there should be some strategies which we can all agree on. We might start with completing the unfinished business of the civil rights movement, namely enforcing non-discrimination laws in such areas as employment, housing, and education. Anyone who thinks that such enforcement is no longer needed should pay a visit to one of the suburban office parks in their area and count the number of blacks employed there, even in relatively unskilled jobs. Or read recent studies showing that real estate brokers continue to steer prospective black homeowners away from predominantly white neighborhoods. This should be a source of concern across the political spectrum, even to those who oppose affirmative action. Affirmative action programs, when properly structured, can open up opportunities otherwise closed to qualified minorities without having an adverse impact on opportunities for white students. Moreover, as a lawyer who's worked on civil rights cases, I can say that where there's strong evidence of prolonged and systematic discrimination by large corporations, trade unions, or branches of municipal government, goals and timetables for minority hiring may be the only meaningful remedy available. Many Americans disagree with me on this as a matter of principle, arguing that our institutions should never take race into account, even if it is to help victims of past discrimination. Fair enough. I understand their arguments and don't expect the debate to be settled anytime soon. But that shouldn't stop us from at least making sure that when two equally qualified persons, one minority and one white, apply for a job, house, or loan, and the white person is consistently preferred, then the government, through its prosecutors and through its courts, should step in to make things right. We should also agree that the responsibility to close the gap can't come from government alone. Minorities, individually and collectively, have responsibilities as well. Many of the social or cultural factors that negatively affect black people, for example, simply mirror, in exaggerated form, problems that afflict America as a whole. Then there's the collapse of the two-parent black household, a phenomenon that is occurring at such an alarming rate when compared to the rest of American society, that what was once a difference in degree has become a difference in kind, a phenomenon that reflects a casualness towards sex and child-rearing among black men that renders black children more vulnerable, and for which there is simply no excuse. Although government action can help change behavior, a transformation in attitudes has to begin in the home, and in neighborhoods, and in places of worship. Community-based institutions, particularly the historically black church, have to help families reinvigorate in young people a reverence for educational achievement, encourage healthier lifestyles, and re-energize traditional social norms surrounding the joys and obligations of fatherhood. But the most important tool to close the gap between minority and white workers may have little to do with race at all. These days, what ails working-class and middle-class blacks and Latinos is not fundamentally different than what ails their white counterparts. Downsizing, outsourcing, automation, wage stagnation, the dismantling of employer-based healthcare and pension plans, and schools that fail to teach young people the skills they need to compete in a global economy. Blacks in particular have been vulnerable to these trends, since they are more reliant on blue-collar manufacturing jobs and are less likely to live in suburban communities where new jobs are being created. And what would help minority workers are the same things that would help white workers. The opportunity to earn a living wage, the education and training that leads to such jobs, labor laws and tax laws that restore some balance to the distribution of the nation's wealth, and health care, child care, and retirement systems that working people can count on. This pattern of a rising tide lifting minority boats has certainly held true in the past. The progress made by the previous generation of Latinos and African Americans occurred primarily because the same ladders of opportunity that built the white middle class were for the first time made available to minorities as well. They benefited, as all people did, from an economy that was growing and a government interested in investing in its people. Not only did tight labor markets, access to capital, and programs like the Pell Grant and Perkins Loan benefit blacks directly, growing incomes and a sense of security among whites made them less resistant to minority claims for equality. The situation is no different today. As recently as 1999, the black unemployment rate fell to record lows and black income rose to record highs, not because of a surge in affirmative action hiring or a sudden change in the black work ethic, but because the economy was booming and government policies took a few modest measures, like the expansion of the earned income tax credit, to spread the wealth around. If you want to know the secret of Bill Clinton's popularity among African Americans, you need to look no further than these statistics. But these same statistics should also force those of us interested in racial equality to conduct an honest accounting of the costs and benefits of our current strategies. Even as we continue to defend affirmative action as a useful, if limited, tool to expand opportunity to underrepresented minorities, we should consider spending a lot more of our political capital convincing America to make the investments needed to assure that all children perform at grade level and graduate from high school, a goal that, if met, would do more than affirmative action to help those black and Latino children who need it the most. Similarly, we should support targeted programs to eliminate existing health disparities between minorities and whites. Some evidence suggests that even when income and levels of insurance are factored out, minorities may still be receiving worse care. But a plan for universal health care coverage would do more to eliminate health disparities between whites and minorities than any race-specific program we might design. An emphasis on universal as opposed to race-specific programs isn't just good policy, it's also good politics. Rightly or wrongly, white guilt has largely exhausted itself in America. Even the most fair-minded of whites, those who would genuinely like to see racial inequality ended and poverty relieved, tend to push back against suggestions of racial victimization or race-specific claims based on the history of race discrimination in this country. Some of this has to do with the success of conservatives in fanning the politics of resentment by wildly overstating, for example, the adverse effects of affirmative action on white workers. But mainly it's a matter of simple self-interest. Most white Americans figure they haven't engaged in discrimination themselves and have plenty of their own problems to worry about. They also know that with a national debt approaching $9 trillion and annual deficits of almost $300 billion, the country has precious few resources to help them with those problems. Proposals that solely benefit minorities and dissect Americans into us and them instead of we may generate a few short-term concessions when the costs to whites aren't too high, but they can't serve as the basis for the kinds of sustained, broad-based political coalitions needed to transform America. On the other hand, universal appeals around strategies that help all Americans, schools that teach, jobs that pay, healthcare for everyone who needs it, a government that helps out after a flood, along with measures that ensure our laws apply equally to everyone, and hence uphold broadly held American ideals, can serve as the basis for such coalitions, even if such strategies disproportionately help minorities. Such a shift in emphasis is not easy. Old habits die hard, and there is always a fear on the part of many minorities that unless racial discrimination, past and present, stays on the front burner, white America will be let off the hook and hard-fought gains may be reversed. I understand these fears. Nowhere is it ordained that history moves in a straight line, and during difficult economic times, it is possible that the imperatives of racial equality get shunted aside. Still, when I look at what past generations of minorities have had to overcome, I am optimistic about the ability of this generation to continue their advance into the economic mainstream. The rungs on the opportunity ladder may have been more slippery for blacks. The admittance of Latinos into firehouses and corporate suites may have been grudging. But despite all that, the combination of economic growth, government investment in broad-based programs to encourage upward mobility, and a modest commitment to enforce the simple principle of non-discrimination was sufficient to pull the large majority of blacks and Latinos into the socioeconomic mainstream within a generation. We need to remind ourselves of this achievement. What's remarkable is not the number of minorities who have failed to climb into the middle class, but the number who succeeded against the odds. Not the anger and bitterness that parents of color have transmitted to their children, but the degree to which such emotions have ebbed. That knowledge gives us something to build on. It tells us that more progress can be made. If universal strategies that target the challenges facing all Americans can go a long way towards closing the gap between blacks, Latinos, and whites, there are two aspects of race relations in America that require special attention, issues that fan the flames of racial conflict and undermine the progress that's been made. With respect to the African American community, the issue is the deteriorating condition of the inner city poor. With respect to Latinos, it is the problem of undocumented workers and the political firestorm surrounding immigration. I hear a sentiment in the African-American community these days that conditions in the heart of the inner city are spinning out of control. Sometimes the conversation will center on statistics, the infant mortality rate, say, or black male unemployment, or the number of black men who can expect to go through the criminal justice system at some point in their lives. But more often the conversation focuses on personal stories, offered as evidence of a fundamental breakdown within a portion of our community, and voiced with a mixture of sadness and incredulity. A teacher will talk about what it's like to have an 8-year-old shout obscenities and threaten her with bodily harm. A public defender will describe a 15-year-old's harrowing rap sheet, or the nonchalance with which his clients predict they will not live to see their 30th year. A pediatrician will describe the teenage parents who don't think there's anything wrong with feeding their toddlers potato chips for breakfast, or who admit to having left their 5 or 6-year-olds alone at home. These are the stories of those who didn't make it out of history's confinement, of the neighborhoods within the black community that house the poorest of the poor, serving as repositories for all the scars of slavery and violence of Jim Crow, the internalized rage and the forced ignorance, the shame of men who could not protect their women or support their families, the children who grew up being told they wouldn't amount to anything and had no one there to undo the damage. There was a time, of course, when such deep intergenerational poverty could still shock a nation. Not anymore. Today, the images of the so-called underclass are ubiquitous, a permanent fixture in American popular culture. Rather than evoke our sympathy, our familiarity with the lives of the black poor has bred spasms of fear and outright contempt. But mostly it's bred indifference. Black men filling our prisons, black children unable to read or caught in a gangland shooting, the black homeless sleeping on grates and in the parks of our nation's capital. We take these things for granted, as part of the natural order, a tragic situation perhaps, but not one for which we are culpable, and certainly not something subject to change. This concept of a black underclass, separate, apart, alien in its behavior and in its values, has also played a central role in modern American politics. It was partly on behalf of fixing the black ghetto that Johnson's War on Poverty was launched, and it was on the basis of that war's failures, both real and perceived, that conservatives turned much of the country against the very concept of the welfare state. A cottage industry grew within conservative think tanks, arguing not only that cultural pathologies, rather than racism or structural inequalities built into our economy, were responsible for black poverty, but that government programs like welfare, coupled with liberal judges who coddled criminals, actually made these pathologies worse. On television, images of innocent children with distended bellies were replaced with those of black looters and muggers. News reports focused less on the black maid struggling to make ends meet and more on the quote-unquote welfare queen who had babies just to collect a check. What was needed, conservatives argued, was a stern dose of discipline, more police, more prisons, more personal responsibility, and an end to welfare. If such strategies could not transform the black ghetto, at least they would contain it and keep hardworking taxpayers from throwing good money after bad. That conservatives won over white public opinion should come as no surprise. Their arguments tapped into a distinction between a deserving and undeserving poor that has a long, varied history in America, an argument that has often been racially or ethnically tinged, and that has gained greater currency during those periods, like the 70s and 80s, when economic times are tough. The response of liberal policymakers and civil rights leaders didn't help. In their urgency to avoid blaming the victims of historic discrimination, they tended to downplay or ignore evidence that entrenched behavioral patterns among the black poor really were contributing to intergenerational poverty. Most famously, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was accused of racism in the early 60s when he raised the alarms about the rise of out-of-wedlock births among the black poor. This willingness to dismiss the role that values played in shaping the economic success of a community strained credulity and alienated working-class whites, particularly since some of the most liberal policymakers lived lives far removed from urban disorder. The truth is, such rising frustration with conditions in the inner city was hardly restricted to whites. In most black neighborhoods, law-abiding, hard-working residents have been demanding more aggressive police protection for years, since they are far more likely to be victims of crime. In private, around kitchen tables, in barber shops, and after church, black folks can often be heard bemoaning eroding work ethics, inadequate parenting, and declining sexual mores with a fervor that would make the Heritage Foundation proud. In that sense, black attitudes regarding the sources of chronic poverty are far more conservative than black politics would care to admit. What you won't hear, though, are blacks using such terms as predator in describing a young gang member, or underclass in describing mothers on welfare, language that divides the world between those who are worthy of our concern and those who are not. For black Americans, such separation from the poor is never an option, and not just because the color of our skin and the conclusions the larger society draws from our color, makes all of us only as free, only as respected, as are the least of us. It's also because blacks know the backstory to the inner city's dysfunction. Most blacks remember the collective story of the Great Migration from the South, how after arriving in the North, blacks were forced into ghettos because of racial steering and restricted covenants, and stacked up in public housing because no one wanted blacks living anywhere else, where the schools were substandard and the parks were underfunded and police protection was non-existent and the drug trade was tolerated. We remember how the plum patronage jobs were reserved for other immigrant groups, and the blue-collar jobs that black folks relied on evaporated, so that what had been intact families began to crack under the pressure, and what had been ordinary children slipped through those cracks until a tipping point was reached, and what had once been the sad exception somehow became the rule. In other words, African Americans understand that culture matters, but that culture is shaped by circumstance. We know that many in the inner city are trapped by their own self-destructive behaviors, but that those behaviors are not innate. And because of that knowledge, the black community remains convinced that if America finds its will to do so, then circumstances for those trapped in the inner city can be changed, and individual attitudes among the poor will change in kind, and the damage can gradually be undone, if not for this generation, then at least for the next. Such wisdom might help us move beyond ideological bickering and serve as the basis for a renewed effort to tackle the problems of inner city poverty. We could begin by acknowledging that perhaps the single biggest thing we could do to reduce such poverty is to encourage teen girls to finish high school and avoid having children out of wedlock. In this effort, school and community-based programs that have a proven track record of reducing teen pregnancy need to be expanded. But parents, clergy, and community leaders also need to speak out more consistently on the issue. We should also acknowledge that conservatives and Bill Clinton were right about welfare as it was previously structured. By detaching income from work and by making no demands on welfare recipients other than a tolerance for intrusive bureaucracy, the old AFDC program sapped people of their initiative and eroded their self-respect. Any strategy to reduce intergenerational poverty has to be centered on work, not welfare. Not only because work provides independence and income, but because work provides order, structure, dignity, and opportunities for growth in people's lives. But we also need to admit that work alone does not assure that people can rise out of poverty. Across America, welfare reform has sharply reduced the number of people on the public dole. It has also swelled the ranks of the working poor, with women churning in and out of the labor market, locked into jobs that don't pay a living wage, forced every day to scramble for adequate childcare, affordable housing, accessible health care, only to find themselves at the end of each month wondering how they can stretch the last few dollars that they have left to cover the food bill, the gas bill, and the baby's new coat. Strategies like an expanded earned income tax credit that help all low-wage workers can make an enormous difference in the lives of these women and their children. But if we're serious about breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty, then many of these women will need some extra help with the basics that those living outside the inner city often take for granted. They need more police and more effective community policing in their neighborhoods to provide them and their children some semblance of personal security. They need access to community-based health centers that emphasize prevention, including reproductive care, nutritional counseling, and in some cases treatment for substance abuse. They need a radical transformation of the schools their children attend and access to affordable child care that will allow them to hold a full-time job or pursue their education. And in many cases, they need help learning to be effective parents. By the time many inner-city children reach the school system, they're already behind, unable to identify basic numbers, colors, or the letters in the alphabet, unaccustomed to sitting still or participating in a structured environment, and often burdened by undiagnosed health problems. They're unprepared not because they're unloved, but because their mothers don't know how to provide what they need. Well-structured government programs, prenatal counseling, access to regular pediatric care, parenting programs, and quality early childhood education programs have a proven ability to help fill the void. Finally, we need to tackle the nexus of unemployment and crime in the inner city so that the men who live there can begin fulfilling their responsibilities. The conventional wisdom is that most unemployed inner-city men could find jobs if they really wanted to work, that they inevitably prefer drug dealing, with its attendant risks but potential profits, to the low-paying jobs that their lack of skills warrant. In fact, economists who have studied the issue, and the young men whose fates are at stake, will tell you that the costs and benefits of the street life don't match the popular mythology. At the bottom or even the middle ranks of the industry, drug dealing is a minimum wage affair. For many inner-city men, what prevents gainful employment is not simply the absence of motivation to get off the streets, but the absence of a job history or any marketable skills, and increasingly, the stigma of a prison record. Government could kickstart a transformation of circumstances for these men by working with private sector contractors to hire and train ex-felons on projects that can benefit the community as a whole, insulating homes and offices to make them energy efficient, perhaps, or laying the broadband lines needed to thrust entire communities into the internet age. Such programs would cost money, of course, although given the annual cost of incarcerating an inmate, any drop in recidivism would help the program pay for itself. Not all of the hardcore unemployed would prefer entry-level jobs to life on the streets, and no program to help ex-felons will eliminate the need to lock up hardened criminals, those whose habits of violence are too deeply entrenched. Still, we can assume that with lawful work available for young men now in the drug trade, crime in many communities would drop. That as a consequence, more employers would locate businesses in these neighborhoods and a self-sustaining economy would begin to take root. That over the course of 10 or 15 years, norms would begin to change. Young men and women would begin to imagine a future for themselves. Marriage rates would rise, and children would have a more stable world in which to grow up. What would that be worth to us? An America in which crime has fallen, and more children are cared for, and cities are reborn, and the biases, fear, and discord that black poverty feeds is slowly drained away. It's hard to quantify the benefits of such changes, precisely because the benefits would be immeasurable. If the problems of inner-city poverty arise from our failure to face up to an often tragic past, the challenges of immigration spark fears of an uncertain future. The demographics of America are changing inexorably and at lightning speed, and the claims of new immigrants won't fit neatly into the black and white paradigm of discrimination and resistance and guilt and recrimination. Across the country, the classic immigrant story is playing itself out. The story of ambition and adaptation, hard work and education, assimilation and upward mobility. Except today's immigrants are living out this story in hyperdrive. As beneficiaries of a nation more tolerant and more worldly than the one immigrants faced generations ago, a nation that has come to revere its immigrant myth, they are more confident in their place here, more assertive of their rights. As a senator, I receive countless invitations to address these newest Americans, where I'm often quizzed on my foreign policy views. Where do I stand on Cyprus, say, or the future of Taiwan? They may have policy concerns specific to fields in which their ethnic groups are heavily represented. Indian American pharmacists might complain about Medicare reimbursements. Korean small business owners might lobby for changes in the tax code. But mostly they want affirmation that they too are Americans. Whenever I appear before immigrant audiences, I can count on some good-natured ribbing from my staff after my speech. According to them, my remarks always follow a three-part structure. I am your friend. Your, fill in the home country, has been a cradle of civilization, and you embody the American dream. They're right. My message is simple. For what I've come to understand is that my mere presence before these newly minted Americans serves notice that they matter, that they are voters critical to my success, and full-fledged citizens deserving of respect. Of course, not all my conversations in immigrant communities follow this easy pattern. In the wake of 9/11, my meetings with Arab and Pakistani Americans, for example, have a more urgent quality, for the stories of detentions and FBI questioning and hard stares from neighbors have shaken their sense of security and belonging. It's in my meetings with the Latino community, though, in neighborhoods like Pilsen and Little Village, towns like Cicero and Aurora, that I'm forced to reflect on the meaning of America, the meaning of citizenship, and my sometimes conflicted feelings about all the changes that are taking place. Of course, the presence of Latinos in Illinois, Puerto Ricans, Colombians, Salvadorans, Cubans, and most of all Mexicans, dates back generations when agricultural workers began making their way north and joined ethnic groups and factory jobs throughout the region. Like other immigrants, they assimilated into the culture. Although like African Americans, their upward mobility was often hampered by racial bias. Shortly after my arrival in Chicago, my own ties to the Latino community were formed. As a young organizer, I often worked with Latino leaders on issues that affected both black and brown residents, from failing schools to illegal dumping to unimmunized children. By the time I returned from law school, new tensions between black and Latinos in Chicago had started to surface. Between 1990 and 2000, the Spanish-speaking population in Chicago rose by 38%, and with this surge in population, the Latino community was no longer content to serve as junior partner in any black-brown coalition. As black businesses and commercial strips struggled, Latino businesses thrived, helped in part by financial ties to home countries and by a customer base held captive by language barriers. Everywhere, it seemed, Mexican and Central American workers came to dominate low-wage work that had once gone to blacks, as waiters and busboys, as hotel maids, and as bellmen. And they made inroads in construction trades that had long excluded black labor. Blacks began to grumble, feel threatened. They wondered if once again they were about to be passed over by those who'd just arrived. There's no denying that many blacks share the same anxieties as many whites about the wave of illegal immigration flooding our southern border. The number of immigrants added to the labor